Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. In recent years, the state legislature has seen an increase in conservative Republicans who are focusing more on personal rights and freedoms. Those rights range from removing federal restrictions on gun laws to voting against anything that might resemble a tax. They've had mixed success with this approach, but they see their role in the state legislature as important. But others wonder if they're consistent. Bob Beck reports from Cheyenne.
I've tried to keep people's liberty in the forefront of my thinking, and I hope I've been able to do that. So it's something I think about every day.
That's State Senator Cale Case of Lander. The Republican has served in the legislature for 20 years. Case is extremely fiscally conservative and is not a big fan of laws in general.
I cast a lot of no votes, and that's because I believe that what we're doing is either unnecessary or interferes with decisions that really ought to be left privately with individuals.
Many Republicans are cautious when it comes to legislation, but Case needs to be completely sold before he votes for something. It appears that Case will stray from his thinking when it comes to the occasional civil rights or environmental cause, but his standard is to do what's best for the state as a whole. Over in the House of Representatives sits Kendall Croker. The 39-year-old from Evansville is in his second term in the House and has quickly established himself as one of the growing number of young conservative voices that have been elected in recent years. Croker owns a motorcycle dealership, so he's worried about laws that impact small businesses. But he says the primary reason he's in the legislature is to protect individual freedoms. So if he's in doubt, he takes a page out of Case's book.
We as a body try to take it upon ourselves to protect everybody from every harm that will be out there. And a lot of times that's just not possible. The intentions are good, but all that results is really less freedom and less liberty. And so I've always been of the opinion, if I'm not completely sure on a bill and I'm in doubt, I always vote no, because I figure if it's a good idea, we can revisit it again.
But some wonder if Croker isn't a hypocrite. For instance, he has voted for bills that would take away rights from gays and lesbians. And this session, he sponsored a bill that would declare an abortion illegal if a heartbeat could be detected from the fetus.
Like with the abortion issue, I believe that a fetus is a human life and therefore is entitled to the same protection under law, you know, as somebody else. You know, so protecting the life of the unborn to me is just as important as protecting the life and rights of the born.
But recluse Representative Sue Wallace says that's crazy.
Freedom is freedom. I don't want government in my business. I don't want them necessarily overstepping their bounds in my community, and I damn sure don't want them overstepping their bounds and invading my personal space or my neighbor's in personal space.
Wallace strongly opposed Croker's abortion bill and was a co-sponsor of legislation that would allow both gay marriage and recognize domestic partnerships in the state. But she is far from liberal. As she stands in the hallway outside the House of Representatives, she points out that she is very fiscally conservative. She's fought for years to deregulate small food vendors, and she's strong on gun rights. In other words, there's days that you're really going to be with her or really against her.
And my hate mail and fan mail will prove that.
But Wallace thinks she is very consistent, and it frustrates her when fellow conservatives think it's okay to meddle in people's lives one day and not the next. Another person who gets frustrated is Dan Neal at the Equality State Policy Center. They strongly support traditionally liberal legislation. Neal says the anti-government approach has cost the state chances to improve health care and public safety.
You know, workplace safety is a classic one where we've insisted that, this state's horrible fatality rate could be reduced by a greater commitment to enforcement. But they'll say, no, we can't have government intrusion in business.
Neal also ridicules the anti-government rhetoric when he notes that the state gets millions in federal money for roads, education, and health care. Lyman Republican Ellen Yeagy smiles and says Neal's point is a good one. Yeagy has served for 6 years and has dedicated himself to removing federal and state gun regulations. He agrees that the state enjoys too many federal handouts and blames other legislators for their hypocrisy.
I think we're a little bit hypocritical, just exactly what you're pointing out. My solution is let's get away from taking federal money. Of course, I don't think the will of the legislature, of the governor, is to stop taking that federal money because that would hurt our spending.
Back in the Senate, Cale Case is mulling a recent vote where the Senate defeated a bill that would have banned discrimination in the workplace against same-sex couples. He says true conservatives should support that type of legislation because it restores freedoms for more citizens. But Case says the fact that the bill hit the floor is a good sign.
Absolutely. And I think it's stunning. You know, there were bills to deprive people of rights, of, you know, and opportunity before. Now we're seeing, let's put in our law that we're not going to discriminate. I think that's really healthy. It's going to be a good thing. It's all going to be okay.
Case says citizens are way ahead of their legislators on these issues, so they just need to catch up. And he thinks legislators will catch up soon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck in Cheyenne.
Former U.S. ambassador to Egypt and Israel will be visiting Jackson next week. Daniel Kurtzer is now a professor at Princeton University and recently edited a book about the Arab-Israeli conflict. During his visit to Wyoming, he'll be giving a talk entitled America and the Middle East, Challenges of Change. He considers it very important for the U.S. to take a leadership role in resolving conflicts in the Middle East and helping countries there transition to democracy.
When the United States is active in the Middle East, it doesn't guarantee success, but it offers, in most cases, the best opportunity for resolving conflicts. When we're inactive, the rest of the world has so far proven incapable of concerted action. So U.S. leadership seems to be very important in particularly harsh conflict situations like Syria, but also in chronic conflict situations like the Arab-Israeli situation.
So when you're talking about the U.S. being active, can you be a little more specific? What kinds of action should we be taking?
Well, I'm talking about diplomatic leadership, and that means formulating ideas, bringing in partners from the international community, developing proposals and suggestions that can motivate the parties to conflict to begin to engage, to think about the kinds of pressures or inducements that may be necessary to make a convincing case, and then to sustain that approach, even though in most cases the road through conflict to resolution is very challenging to navigate.
One of the conflicts that's been going on, obviously, for decades is the Arab-Israeli conflict, and you just edited a book about that. I'm curious what your outlook is. Will that conflict ever be resolved?
Well, the premise of the book is really twofold. Number one is that the conflict is resolvable, even though the resolution has eluded policymakers and politicians for a long time. And secondly, that without a very active United States role in promoting a conflict resolution process, the parties in the region are unlikely to do it themselves for a lot of reasons. The politics in both Israel and Palestine are quite complicated. Leaders have been unwilling to take gambles and risks, and most everybody is turning to the United States to stimulate and catalyze some kind of progress.
What can the U.S. do in this situation, though, to help resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict? I mean, certainly amongst many in the Arab world, there is a perception that the U.S. is biased in favor of Israel. What can the U.S. actually realistically do in concrete terms?
What the United States has traditionally done in the Middle East conflict is essentially to bend toward Israel with respect to its security requirements, but to bend toward the Arabs with respect to the political and related issues. In other words, Israel's security has been very important to the United States, but the realization of the political goals of the Arabs should be, and in the past has been, equally important. In the current situation, what that means is to help the parties navigate to an outcome in which a Palestinian state is created in essentially the area that was occupied in 1967. I say essentially because it may involve some territorial adjustments and territorial swaps. The border is to be demarcated. But that outcome needs to assure that Israel's security is not degraded to such a significant extent that Israel would not want to take the risks for peace.
Do you have any specific advice for the Obama administration as he's entering his second term?
Well, in the book, The Pathways to Peace, my own chapter, in fact, provided six concrete policy goals that I thought the administration should consider. For example, the first of those six items was to start off the peace process by demarcating the borders in a manner that would enhance rather than degrade security. It's almost 65 years since Israel was created, and it has never enjoyed internationally recognized borders. A Palestinian state that we all talk about has no shape until the borders are decided. So the first order of business, which in fact President Obama referred to back in 2011, was to, in a sense, create the contours or the shape of a Palestinian state living next door to Israel. And then I think once that's done, some of the other suggestions were, how do you fill that peace process with content with respect to economic relations and political relations to assure that it becomes a durable peace settlement?
Daniel Kurtzer, former ambassador to Egypt and Israel, currently professor of Middle Eastern Policy Studies at Princeton. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Willa.
Daniel Kurtzer will be in Jackson February 5th through 8th.
When we come back, we'll hear why Grand Teton National Park can't end its annual elk hunt. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. The death of a grizzly bear in Grand Teton National Park on Thanksgiving Day 2012 has triggered calls for ending the park's annual elk hunt. A hunting party shot the grizzly after the hunters said the bear charged them. Park Superintendent Mary Gibson Scott calls the bear's death a travesty. It's the first hunting-related grizzly death in the park, but Scott says her agency, the National Park Service, can't just end the hunt. Rebecca Huntington has more.
Park Superintendent Mary Gibson Scott says she understands the public outrage over the bear's death.
I saw the grizzly bear, the dead carcass, on the back of a truck on Thanksgiving morning. Don't think that I don't take that extremely, deeply personal.
But Scott says it's not that simple to end the park elk hunt. The law that expanded Grand Teton National Park in 1950 requires the National Park Service and Wyoming Game and Fish Commission to work together to jointly come up with recommendations for an elk reduction program, basically setting a hunting season for elk in the park.
It's in the legislation. Legislation can be amended, but that's not within my authority. My authority is to implement and administer the law. I don't create law.
Scott says one reason the hunt endures is because conditions, including elk migration patterns and a lack of natural winter range, haven't changed since 1950.
And one has to ask the question, why have conditions not changed? Why do we have such a high elk population, the largest in the country, that it requires a harvest every year in Grand Teton National Park? And the answer is because of supplemental feeding. The winter range for this herd comes in on flatbed trucks.
State and federal agencies have been feeding elk for more than a century because human development has taken up the valley floors. And that means less access to natural forage for the elk.
The system, from an ecological standpoint, is highly artificial.
Steve Kane is a senior wildlife biologist for the park. He's been working on how to manage the elk herd for many years. He says artificial feeding has implications not just for elk, but also for other wildlife. Artificial feeding prevents elk from starving in the winter and leaving carcasses for grizzlies to scavenge on when they emerge from hibernation in the spring. Instead, the bears now dine on gut piles left by hunters in the fall, which can sometimes lead to encounters, like the one that killed the grizzly on Thanksgiving morning.
Clearly, predators have increased since 1950. We now have healthy populations of grizzly bears and wolves back in the system, and they are doing their share at taking elk calves and regulating the population, but we still have literally thousands of elk that migrate through the park, and that's the one opportunity that the agencies have to harvest and manage the elk herd.
Environmental groups have sued to stop artificial feeding, but that could mean fewer elk for hunters, wildlife watchers, and even predators, such as grizzlies. If feeding stopped, elk may look for their next meal on cattle feedlines, where they could increase the risk of spreading the disease brucellosis. All that makes ending feeding a politically and economically dicey decision. Even so, Scott says, park officials are looking for options to tweak the park hunt.
Whether that's changing areas, hunter density, number of bullets, whatever you can think of, we are internally analyzing and discussing that to mitigate to the degree we can.
But Scott says she can't end the hunt unilaterally. And park biologist Steve Kane adds that ending the hunt would essentially create a giant safe zone for elk. It wouldn't take the elk long to figure out how to outsmart hunters by essentially staying in the safe zone. And that would impact hunting outside the park. Although the hunt is likely to continue, Scott agrees with critics that it is an awkward fit for a national park.
An elk reduction program or a hunt is not consistent with traditional values of national parks. Hunting in national parks is extremely unique. So it does have inconsistencies with the values of wildlife viewing and visitor experience. We know that. But the law is the law.
If people want to see that change, Scott says they'll have to take it up with the body that writes the law, and that's Congress. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
When we come back, we'll hear about a new program at UW that's aimed at training people how to negotiate oil and gas contracts, and we'll hear about how the drought is affecting the ag community. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Bob Beck at the state capitol in Cheyenne. Last year was the driest year Wyoming has seen in more than a century, and the dry spell has not let up. As a result, farmers and ranchers have had to make tough decisions and are deeply concerned about their livelihood for the coming year. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
2012 was a rough year for Rocky Foy. He's a rancher near Glendoe, and he usually grows about 400 tons of hay each year, which is enough to support his herd of cattle. But last year, he produced only 28 tons. That left him with two options, sell cows or buy hay. He chose to do both, selling off about 15% of his herd and purchasing hay for the rest. The hay was hard to come by, though.
I got started early, and I found some local, but towards the end, most of it was gone. We were getting hay out of North Dakota.
And it was expensive, about double what it used to cost.
Plus the trucking coming out of North Dakota, the freight cost as much as the load of hay.
UW Extension agent Dallas Mount says ranchers all over Wyoming faced the same problems. He says most held on to as many cows as possible because they didn't want to destroy a herd they'd spent decades building up. But he says keeping the cows came at a significant cost. Most ranchers lost about $200 per cow.
When you look at the average profit from a cow in a normal year is around $100, then essentially we've invested our profitability for the next 2 years to make it through last year.
Mount says if the drought ends soon, the investment will pay off.
The expectation and the hope is that with livestock numbers down all over the United States, if we ever do get rain again, the price will be strong. So if we can keep the cows together, hopefully we'll have some pretty good prices to sell into in the coming years.
But so far, the weather is not cooperating. Snowpack is below normal, and the National Weather Service reports that nearly 90% of the state is experiencing severe drought or worse. Rancher Rocky Foy says another year of drought would be devastating.
If it's another year like last year where it didn't even green up and we end up buying hay again, it's going to be very difficult for about all of us, I think, because there's just not that big of a margin to start with.
Hay producers are worried, too. 2012 wasn't too bad for them because many had leftover hay from the year before, and they were able to sell it for high prices. So even though they grew less, they didn't necessarily lose money. But now their reserves of hay are used up, and ranchers across the country are downsizing their herds.
There may not be any cows in the country to sell the hay to. If we have another year like last year, it was unprecedented.
That's Kevin Bars, a hay producer near Lusk. He says the only reason he was able to grow hay at all last year is because he has an irrigation pivot.
The amount that we had to run our circle was just amazing. Typically, you can shut it off after a rain of some sort, and we pretty much let the thing run from the time we got done putting up one cutting of hay until we started the next, and it just ran steady.
And that drew down the water level in his well. By the end of the summer, it was producing 100 gallons a minute less than it was supposed to. Still, Extension agent Dallas Mount says there is room for optimism.
Winter snow has very little to do with actual forage production on the rangeland. More than anything, spring rains have the greatest impact. So that's where really all the money is riding right now, is on the spring rains.
Mount says good spring rains could more than make up for low snowpack. But if the rains don't come, he says the ag community will be in major disaster mode. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
The University of Wyoming just initiated a new program out of its School of Energy Resources. The Professional Land Management Concentration will train landmen. Those are people who look for untapped oil and gas and other resources and negotiate contracts between their owners and companies that want to develop them. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports that the program is just in time.
You know, I can explain kind of what the day in the life of a landman or a week in the life of a landman is, but when you do it, you'll get a good sense of, you know, what you're looking forward to. So we want you to know that this is what excites you.
At a recent informational meeting about the new land management program, Director Don Roth stood in front of the 9 young men who showed up and tried to sell them on it.
Both on the same side. How do you work with that? So, you know, you'll get a view of that. So that's going to be
the program, which is actually a concentration within the School of Energy Resources, is brand new this semester. It's a multidisciplinary hodgepodge of classes like geology, petroleum engineering, accounting, law, and hands-on internships and seminars that will train students to be land managers, or landmen. Travis Bramer from Sterling, Colorado, was one of the students at that meeting.
From where I'm from, landmen always have kind of a bad name to them, you know. It's kind of like a used car salesman or something. Like they're just trying to swindle you into getting the land.
But his advisor told him that's not entirely true, so he's thinking about it. He wasn't the only student to make the used car salesman analogy, and he wasn't the only one to stay interested despite the analogy. That's because the profession, through its accrediting agency, the American Association of Professional Landmen, is trying hard to shed that reputation. And UW's program will help them do that. This program will only be the 7th in North America, the 6th in the U.S. accredited by the AAPL, and it's the newest, most state-of-the-art program. It also has a very Western specialization. Here's Roth.
In particular, we looked at training our students to understand split estate issues where you have public lands, Native American lands, private lands, different entities that own particular areas, and this creates a very complex situation.
Wyoming State President of the AAPL, Mark Strawn, is a landman, and he worked with Roth and SER to plan the new program and develop its curriculum. He says older landmen either learned on the job or apprenticed.
There's this group of landmen that were taught in the old style with 30-plus years, but that group is very small. And then the group from, say, 30 years to 5 years of experience, there's very, very few people out there anymore to even do that. And then there's this mass new entrance into the profession in the last 5 to 8 years. It's a total different thing, and the university program is so important to that.
It's different because, like the work of mining and oil and gas development, the work of the landman has gotten so much more complex. Strawn has been in the business for over 3 decades.
When I started, we didn't work with computers. We hand drew things on maps, and now everything's done off of computers. And what the current day students are taking is so highly technological now that it makes it even more important to have that advanced education and learning.
He says you can still learn by apprenticing, but graduates from programs like UW's have a higher level of education, will have had professional ethics and law classes, and are somewhat policed by AAPL if they become members, which they're more likely to do. At the meeting, Roth said they could even join now. Another student at the meeting, Fred Eden from Powell, is already convinced.
With the professional certifications that are coming and the shift in the career field from a fly-by-night operation that just whoever could figure out how to get the rights to much more of a professional certified, vast improvement over what's been happening in the past.
For yet other students, though, it might be the profession's other attributes that hook them.
The job stability is one thing me and my parents definitely looked at. I've always been interested in energy, and I've always enjoyed rocks. I never really thought about making a profession out of it.
That's Truman Marama from Lakewood, Colorado.
A lot of us are really excited for the travel, the amount of work we would have, and just the experiences we'd have to do it. It's pretty rare and exciting.
According to Strawn and Roth, technological advances in energy development revitalize the need for landmen, and it's now a job that looks steadily into the future. Here's Strawn again.
That stability by unlocking the technique of horizontal drilling has really caused a lot of these companies to come up and work all around the country, and therefore has really stabilized our profession. I would say it's a great time right now for students to come into the profession, whereas if you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I may not have given you that same answer.
Roth says they already have 9 students in the program, and they anticipate another 10 to 15 next semester. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhurov.
Next week, an event called the Found Footage Festival is coming to Laramie. We're joined now by curator Nick Pruer. He describes the festival as a guided tour through his vast collection of old, funny videos.
My buddy Joe and I find old VHS tapes at thrift stores and garage sales across the country. We have 5,000 of them. And these are training videos and exercise videos and home movies and things that weren't meant to be shown in public, and we show them in public.
So I imagine that some of them are pretty goofy.
Yeah, they're all really silly, and I guess the litmus test for us is whether they're unintentionally funny. So, you know, whatever the video is trying to do, it has to fail at in some entertaining way. So that's kind of what we're looking for.
So give us a sense of what some of these films are. What are some of the ones that you'll be showing?
We found one at a thrift store in New Jersey, and it was called Magical Rainbow Sponge. And, you know, that title catches your eye. And so we picked it up. But it's a crafting how-to video, like arts and crafts how-to. And those are always boring. But I have to say, this is the one exception we've found. And it's because of the host. It's this woman named Dee Grunig, who is just so almost psychotically enthusiastic about the sponging technique she's come up with, that it just causes her to lose her mind. I mean, she's making these excited little yelps throughout the video, and so we cut together just all her little excited yelps and whinnies, and she's just very excited about sponging, and that comes across in the video.
And you've got some about how to train your ferret also.
Yeah, we did. We found one called Ferret Fun and Fundamentals, and it's hosted by this man and woman, ferret experts. And these are people that, like, I don't know, we feel like even if you didn't know they made this video, you just saw them on the street, you'd still know they own ferrets. They just have that look about them. And even though this video is not trying to do this, it makes a pretty strong case for why you should never get a ferret. They basically are the most obnoxious animals you could ever bring into your home.
So what gave you the idea to put together this found footage festival?
Basically, Joe and I, the other curator, we've known each other since sixth grade, and this is something we just do to entertain ourselves and our friends. I mean, we grew up in a small town in Wisconsin, and there wasn't a lot going on, so we would find old videotapes, and the first one we found was in a McDonald's break room where I was working in 1991. And that's what kind of started it all, was this McDonald's training video. It was for McDonald's janitors. And I put it in one day out of boredom, and it was so ridiculous that I thought, Joe needs to see this. This cannot stay in the break room. And, the world needs to see this video. So, it became this cult. We'd have friends over, have this running commentary of jokes along with this training video. And that just got us thinking, there has to be more ridiculous material out there on VHS. So, that began the quest to look in out-of-the-way places for more, video gems to have fun with.
Now, I can imagine that in order to find videos that are funny, you probably had to sift through a lot of home videos that were really dull.
Oh, yeah. 90% of the videos we find are just dreadful and boring. Like, I mean, people, might say that a lot of the videos that make the cut in the show are bad, but they're bad in the right way. But most of the videos we find are just plain bad, boring bad. And there's a big distinction. So yeah, it's mind-numbing to have to sift through all of this VHS material. But we're kind of masochists in that way. We built up a pretty high tolerance, so we're willing to suffer for other people's entertainment.
Now, will you be looking for more goofy footage in thrift stores as you're traveling across the U.S. with this festival?
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we keep touring around with the festival, is we have to gather new material. So, whenever we get to a new city, we hit all the local thrift stores, and if there's any garage sales going on, we'll hit those. And we're looking for VHS tapes that have been discarded or that are for sale. And we can't wait, since we've never done a show in Wyoming, to go to Laramie. We're going to be in Cheyenne just combing thrift stores, and hope to have some locally sourced videos next time we come through town.
Has anyone in one of the videos that you've included contacted you, seen these and contacted you?
Yeah, that happens sometimes. We often try to track down people in the videos just to, sate our own curiosity about, how these videos came about. And so we do, track those people down, interview them, and then play the interviews at the show. But we also get contacted occasionally. Actually, we were doing a show in Minneapolis not too long ago, And a guy came up to us afterwards and said, hey, do you recognize me? And I said, no. And then all of a sudden it just hit me. This was a guy who was in a series of safety videos that were basically showing on-the-job accidents, what not to do kind of thing. And he was the guy who got his hand caught in the table saw in this, you know, safety video. And it was like meeting a celebrity. I was like, I could, you know, he was 15 years older, but he still looked the same. And in our small little world, these are, you know, this is like meeting Tom Cruise. I shook his hand. I got my picture taken with him. Maybe that's sad, but, when, you know, luckily the people we meet who are in the videos, I think they're flattered by the attention, and they see that what we're doing isn't mean-spirited. So they're on board for it.
Nick Prewer with the Found Footage Festival, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Willa.
The Found Footage Festival will be in Laramie's Griffin Theater on February 8th at 7:30 p.m. Anyone with an old VHS video they think would be a good addition to the festival is encouraged to bring it along.
When we come back, we'll take a tour of the Wyoming Whiskey Distillery. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck at the State Capitol in Cheyenne.
And I'm Willow Belden. Craft breweries and distilleries are hot right now. Not to be outdone, Wyoming entrepreneurs created a bourbon distillery in Kirby using local ingredients from the Bighorn Basin and bearing the name Wyoming Whiskey. After 4 years of aging the first batch, Wyoming Whiskey flew off the shelves when it was released exclusively in Wyoming in early December. Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez visited the distillery and explored the hype. She filed this report.
It was a state record. As soon as the Wyoming Liquor Division, which handles all the distribution in the state, put the first 3,000 cases of Wyoming whiskey up for sale, retailers snatched it up in less than a minute. Only 75 out of 1,250 retailers were able to buy up that inventory. Wyoming Whiskey was able to release a few hundred more bottles to other retailers to smooth over hurt feelings, but this stuff was scarce. A couple weeks after the release, J.J. Moran, who owns the Four Winds Liquor and Lounge in Cheyenne, read aloud a sign he posted at the bar.
Wyoming Whiskey, $6 per shot. That's the most expensive shot that we pour, as a matter of fact.
And why are people willing to pay for it?
Because it's Wyoming and it's something new and they want to taste it because you can't get any more until the next batch comes out now.
They won't have to wait much longer. The liquor division is taking orders for more Wyoming whiskey until Valentine's Day, and the bourbon will ship out to bars and packaged liquor stores statewide on the 20th. The Wyoming Whiskey Distillery is the tallest building in Kirby and one of the only businesses. Two stories high, it's full of huge, shiny equipment. The smell of warm grains pervades every room. It was the brainchild of the governor's brother and sister-in-law, Brad and Kate Mead, and their friend David DeFazio. The trio scouted out a celebrity of the bourbon world to make Wyoming whiskey a reality. They plucked former Maker's Mark master distiller Steve Nally from his retirement in Kentucky and invited him to build a distillery and a brand from scratch.
It was a chance that I dove into eagerly, but at the same time, you know, being in a new region, not knowing how the grains would turn out, how the water was here, I knew what I wanted to do, but I wasn't sure that it would turn out like that. And when you put the product together new, you have to wait 4 years to know what it's going to be.
Bourbon fans hold a variety of standards for how the liquor should be made, but here's what U.S. law says. Bourbon must be made from a grain mixture that is at least 51% corn. It has to be aged in new charred oak barrels, distilled at no more than 160 proof, barreled at no more than 125 proof, and bottled at 80 proof or more. It does not, by law, have to be made in Bourbon County, Kentucky. It can be called bourbon at almost any age, but after being aged in barrels for 2 years, it's earned the right to have straight bourbon printed on its labels. Wyoming whiskey meets all this criteria, and it's aged for 4 years to enhance flavor. Most distilleries blend bourbons from different barrels before bottling.
The big boys, you know, like Jim Beam, the different bigger distilleries, they go in and select the best of the best. Somebody like Wyoming Whiskey, we don't have that luxury. You know, we only put out one product, so everything we put out has to be that.
Wyoming Whiskey has run a formidable marketing campaign and visited towns across the state hosting tastings.
Here are my tasting notes for Wyoming Whiskey Bourbon.
Its big release caught the attention of whiskey critic Mark Gillespie, who hosts the Whiskey Cast podcast. He traveled to Kirby from New Jersey for Wyoming Whiskey's grand opening, and he was impressed.
It is one of the best bourbons I've ever tasted, and I'm scoring Wyoming Whiskey a 95.
A ringing endorsement if ever there was one. But bourbon drinkers are an opinionated bunch with diverse and particular palates. The intense demand for Wyoming whiskey at Wyoming bars was followed by intensely mixed reviews. Some folks love it. Others complain of a harsh aftertaste. Amateur whiskey connoisseur Rob Miller ordered shots of Wyoming whiskey for himself and a friend at Front Street Tavern in Laramie last week. Miller says the bourbon has potential, but it's too young.
Not number one diesel, not jet fuel, but it needs a little more time in the barrel.
Miller says he'd be interested in trying it again in about 8 years. Wyoming Whiskey's COO David DeFazio says he's heard similar critiques of how young the whiskey tastes, and he says they have a plan to work with that.
We will be holding back supply of our product from each season to be used at our discretion in the future. And some of that will be mixed into the four-year-old product to slowly bring the age of it up to a closer to a five-year and then ultimately a six-year, but that's going to take some time just because of the inventory that we have and time.
DeFazio says there are big plans for Wyoming Whiskey. After the remaining 2009 season bourbon is distributed this month and again in the summer, the eventually more mature 2010 season will be released this coming December. DeFazio says there will be plenty more to go around, and they're even considering releasing Wyoming whiskey in other states. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Rebecca Martinez.
The Latifas Quartet is celebrated in their home country of Moldova. They've been featured in the film The Other Europeans, a documentary highlighting the music of Eastern European communities that have emerged from Soviet domination, but which remain relatively unknown to Americans. The nonprofit Worlds of Music is sponsoring the Latifas Quartet's tour across Wyoming, but the band recently stopped by to talk about their music with Wyoming Public Radio's Grady Kirkpatrick.
The Latifas Quartet includes four master musicians: pan flutist Boris Rudenko, violinist Marin Bunia, accordionist Edgar Stefanet, and cymbalamus Gregory Severin. I spoke with Dr. Diana Bunia, ethnomusicologist and associate professor at the Academy of Music, Theater, and Fine Arts in Chișinău, Moldova. Her daughter Maria provided English translation. What are some of the regions and types of music that have shaped Latifas Quartet?
In the Romanian folkloric area, there are three main regions, Moldova, Muntenia, and Transylvania. But nowadays, together with the globalization process, Latifas Quartet performs music from all the zones, folkloric zones of Romania.
How does the Latifas Quartet express and reflect Moldovan culture?
La Taifas Quartet has a traditional music components, and they try to preserve the style and the traditions of authentic Moldovan music.
Is there usually dancing at the performances?
If people hear some dance music being performed, of course they will start to dance. But they also are very good listeners, so they can listen also to slow melodies or songs.
I also talked with Dr. Victoria Tukachenko, Associate Professor at the Academy of Music, Theater, and Fine Arts. What do you hope audiences will take away after seeing and hearing La Taifas Quartet?
I hope that they will create some impression, some idea what Moldovan music is, how it sounds, what rhythms, what energies it accumulates. And this music is very unusual, very authentic, and I hope that next time that somebody who visited this concert and listened to this concert will hear music from Moldova, he will recognize it. It's very important. So it's a new color of this multicolored picture of world music process. One small but important part of this picture.
Have you and the La Taifas Quartet enjoyed touring and playing for audiences in Wyoming?
Very much, because, you know, for us, we understand very good that there is a real America, authentic America. We brought authentic music, and we see here authentic American culture and American people from this part of the country. We have read a lot about this part in our childhood, about cowboys, about the creation of American nation and American history. And now it's a big pleasure and big challenge to see everything with our own eyes. And we met wonderful people. Every day we are staying in another city, meeting new people, and we feel as at home, actually, this, I don't know, 5 or how many thousand kilometers from our native country.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Grady Kirkpatrick.
Thanks to Rod Garnett, professor of music at the University of Wyoming, Northwest College in Powell, and Wyoming Public Radio's Anna Rader for production assistance. The La Taifas Quartet is playing in Buffalo this weekend and Laramie this coming week. More information is available at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
In anticipation of Valentine's Day, University of Wyoming student Zach Anderson began advertising his services around campus. The English and French major is offering customized sonnets for a fee. Wyoming Public Media requested that Anderson write a love poem for us.
Dispatches from the Western Front. Here, nigh the end of our postmodern age, the news is bred on free-range server farms, and in the brains of citizenry rage, incertitude, distress, ennui, alarm, complacency. These bitter villains leech the human spirit from our cynic scene. Forgotten is the bliss of breathing speech. The word is writ in pixels on a screen. But radio's vox populi remains in modulated frequencies of truth, and beaming out above the wind-burned plains, transmissions that no ignorance can mute. Radio, though other media fall, yours is the voice that may unite us all. I'm Zach Anderson.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Tara Orr is our web editor. You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates, including updates from the state legislative session, you can follow us on Twitter. You can find me under the name Butter Bob. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.